You're listening to 99.1 WQRT LP, and welcome to Radio Free Book Club for November 2023. I'm Ken Honeywell. I'm a writer and reader from Indianapolis. Today we're talking about maybe one of the surprising hits of last year. It's a first novel by a young writer from South Bend. Her name is Tess Gunty, and the book is The Rabbit Hutch, which is the winner of the 2022 National Book Award for Fiction. So, quite an impressive debut. The Rabbit Hutch is set mostly in the northern Indiana city of Vacaville, where some white guy establishment types have plans to, quote, transform Vacaville from a dying post-industrial city into a startup hub, attracting talent from around the world. And our protagonist and one of the novel's major characters, most of the novel's major characters, live in a low-income apartment building known as the Rabbit Hutch. That sort of sets the scene, but it doesn't really scratch the surface of the book. Fortunately for all you listeners, we have one great cast of book club members to dig well below the surface. I know this because they're all veterans of the show. I would be very happy if they would introduce themselves. How about let's start over on this side? Hello, Tracy.
Well, hello. Tracy Kumbe, marketing writer, and the days are getting shorter. I'm in full baking mode.
Oh, yeah. What are you baking?
Key lime tart this last weekend.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That sounds superb.
I'm Kate Shoup. I'm an Indianapolis writer and reader like Ken, and I'm just waiting for snow.
All right. You are you expecting it in Indianapolis this year, Kate?
Eventually. I know it doesn't do any good here, but I just like it. I'm the only person I know that likes it, but yeah. I do like it.
Yeah. I like snow. Okay. We both like snow.
I like snow, too.
Oh, okay. All right. I feel better.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. Tracy? No, you're not going to.
Not your hard no.
Yeah. Hello, Susan.
Hello. I'm Susan Neville, an Indianapolis writer and reader as well. And I don't have any kind of fun fact, but I'm willing to accept baked goods from Tracy.
That is.
At any moment. So.
Always a great option there.
Yeah, we're doing carbs.
Oh, for sure.
Thanks, Susan. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We have Tracy, who kind of picked this book, Susan, who I believe has interviewed the author,
yeah,
and Kate, who I know has just a folder full of notes. So
the nerd.
I know we're kind of champing at the bit to talk about this, but before we do, I need to remind listeners that we will definitely be spoiling The Rabbit Hutch. Although I'm not sure, oddly, it's kind of a not very spoilery book, I don't think. But if you're going to read The Rabbit Hutch and you don't want to know what happens, you'll probably want to stop listening and come back at a later time, which fortunately is easy to do because you can find this in all the episodes of Radio Free Book Club is the name of the show, on Mixcloud, on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, just about anywhere you stream podcasts. Should you read The Rabbit Hutch? Let's talk about that. Let's get going.
Actually, you just said something really interesting there. I'm so curious what you meant about it being kind of unspoilable.
Well, I don't think it is very surprising. I don't think anything that happens is particularly surprising. It's foreshadowed to the point that I was not particularly surprised about anything that happened. Now, I don't know if anyone else has that opinion. I also read it twice, so I'm hoping it's not just my second reading, but I don't. And I'm not sure that takes away from anything. I wasn't particularly disappointed in not being surprised, but I don't think it was too surprising.
Well, the first scene has like a stream of consciousness of pretty much everything that happens. It's just not in story form. It's just like a bunch of nouns.
Right.
Yeah.
And then as you read, as you said a second time, you start to pick out, oh, you're like, oh, well, duh. Okay. You see, when you read it the first time, you can't see how these things are all going to connect. But I agree with you that the foreshadowing makes it sort of impossible to be like, what? At the end.
Except for a very big element that's foreshadowed and then doesn't read. It was kind of a cheat.
Yeah, that I agree with that. Do you mean how like it started with like those flashes of the different people in the apartments and it?
Oh, I don't mean that.
Oh, okay. What
no,
do you mean?
No, I mean how it kept talking about Blandine leaving her body, which is exactly where the book starts, and you keep leading up to this, and then I expected her to die from that.
That is true. Yes.
And that's the only real surprise. I mean, the only thing that I think you could spoil in the book is, does she die or does she not die? And even when she does leave her body for a second, I was thinking.
I thought that too.
Yeah.
When they cut to the hospital, I was like, hold on.
Yeah.
Who's in the hospital?
Who's in the hospital?
Yeah.
Right. So now 6 minutes into this, we've really spoiled about the only thing we could spoil.
Sorry. Right. Exactly.
So. Good job, us. That's efficient.
Our bad.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we warned you. So, Tracy. What was it that just kind of flabbergasted you about this book?
Flabbergasted? I don't think anything flabbergasted. I really enjoyed the ride of it. The like you said, I do, you know, it takes you, it kind of tells you where it's taking you along. But there's some weird happening for sure. And there are such interesting women in this book. There's Elsie, who writes her own obituary and does a bang-up job of it. And then Blandine, who has an amazing scene where she's telling off her older lover and blaming it on capitalism, basically. It's a phenomenal takedown.
Of both her former lover and capitalism.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Susan, what do you think?
Oh,
just in general.
Oh, just in general.
Yeah.
I have had a long relationship with this book because I did interview her. So I read it a couple times before and then looked at it again and I've talked to her about it. And so my first reaction was, oh, my God, this is an incredibly talented writer, sentence by sentence, just really, really interesting, amazing, blown away. And my second response was, but also a little bit like an MFA thesis, where, you know, everything's kind of included and, you know, things that maybe could have been changed, but it is, I think, brilliantly written, and she takes a lot of interesting risks, I think. Including, I mean, it reminded me a little bit of A Visit to the Goon Squad, because she uses like this kind of polyphonic, you know, voices, different people are speaking, and even has a chapter which is a graphic novel in the middle of it that her brother actually did the illustrations, very talented family, incredibly talented family. So, and that reminded me a little bit of the PowerPoint in Goon Squad, which made me weep. And this little graphic piece without words sort of did as well. It was just amazing.
It was very powerful.
Yeah.
Did anyone else think, did her style remind you of David Foster Wallace? Did anyone
Absolutely
think that?
Absolutely not.
No.
You know what? At a certain point, it just hit me to the point that I had to Google it, and I am not alone in thinking that she reminded me of David Foster Wallace. And I'm not sure what it was. Actually, the part of it was the good sentence writing, but part of it was also just kind of the absurdity of certain elements of the story. Kind
of
the over-the-top absurdity.
And then also, I think she's kind of a maximalist writer like Wallace. I mean, there's a lot of stuff, lists and you know, objects and long sentences and short. I mean, she's a stylist like he was.
For sure. Kate? What do your notes say?
Well, I have 8 pages of type notes here. So I would agree with Susan. I felt, I guess what I should say is I loved the words in this book. She just has these beautiful, beautiful sentences and descriptions where, like, just as an example, and sometimes really sly and funny, like she describes there's one sentence where she's describing a character and it, she says, a lethally stylish coiffure described Joan's hair as the color of February. And poor Joan is also described as the kind of person who would have a bird feeder and just all these great, like you can see that person.
Amazing,
you know, just
details.
perfect details like that. So from a, and like even insights, there were just, she would have these sentences where I would just be like, oh my God, yes, that, you know, but I do feel like for me, the book as a whole did not hold up. It didn't quite do what I thought it was going to do at the beginning. I was confused by the use of those flash scenes of the different people in the different apartments.
Mm-hmm. The first time I read
many
it,
many of whom,
much.
For me, never really came back into play. What I thought was going to happen was it was going to be a book about connection and how we're all connected, even when we don't know we're connected. And I'm a real sucker for a book like that. But I feel like there were just a lot of pieces of that book that you could have taken out completely, and it wouldn't have affected the trajectory of the book as a whole. Mm-hmm. And that was frustrating for me. I just felt like she needed someone to tell her, take this whole thing and just put it aside for later. Maybe you can use it in something else.
Can you think of like what's a good
for
example
me it was,
of a part that could be taken out?
For me, it was the Moses, that whole storyline with Moses. I just couldn't see. I don't know. I could have done without. Like, I feel like the book would have held up just as well without all of that. And, you know, maybe there was just some aspect of it I'm not picking up on or that I didn't understand. But for me, that could have gone, I feel like. And you could have still had the stuff with Elsie, because for me, the interesting thing about Elsie was her status as the star of that show, Meet the Neighbors. And ultimately, what I've concluded is I feel like the book is about a lack of neighborliness now. I think that's where she was going. So we've all substituted media and like social media and TV and all these other things for actual connection. And what's lacking is real connection. So that was finally, after 8 pages of notes, what I decided about it. But I do feel like structurally, I just feel like there were parts that needed to go.
I felt that same kind of confusion in the second chapter where we are introduced to Blondine, and then the second chapter we're moving around from place to place in the building, and I was like, I'll never keep this character straight.
Right.
I'll never care about
right.
that.
But,
turns out,
but thank goodness you didn't have to.
Yeah,
really.
Thank goodness
right.
you didn't have
but,
to.
But it seems strange to put that at the beginning of a book, because that's the part where you're said, I just couldn't understand what it was doing there.
I think one of the things she mentioned is that it started out, she thought she was doing a story collection, and then it turned into something else. I will say something about the Moses section, because I love the fact that he breaks glow sticks and covers yeah. himself with glow sticks, and then, you know, goes into people's houses and scares them. And I also think that thematically, to me, what the book is primarily about is the mysticism and Blondine's, you know, thinking about how to be good and how to be virtuous and, you know, whether she should stay in Vacaville or leave. And Moses, I mean, a couple chapters, I think, before Moses, you see him as this glowing person. Blondine says something about her favorite female mystic was Hildegard.
Mm-hmm.
Hildegard, and that Hildegard said that, you know, God appears as light.
Oh,
and
okay.
So I think what she was, it was a very Flannery O'Connor move, I think, to include Moses, because he literally, you know, she takes something like a theological idea and then makes it literal, like O'Connor did always. You know, the Holy Spirit appears on the ceiling of somebody's bedroom as a literal stain on the ceiling. I mean, you know, she literalizes it. So I think that's why she included Moses. The part that didn't feel quite right to me was the kind of obligatory young woman with a teacher who takes advantage of her, although I thought she had a really interesting, you know, kind of approach to it. It was the most, oh, yeah, needed a reason for her to be like this and to stay there and to not go on to college, which, you know, she was clearly the smartest young person in her age group in Vacaville and had a scholarship and things like that.
It was almost like it was a vehicle to put her in the place where she was.
But it was a good story. It would have been a good story by itself, too.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, again, interesting.
Yeah, Tracy, I wonder what you think about that. I felt like that section of the book was, I mean, kind of tonally a little bit different from the rest of the book. It felt more realistic than everything else happening in the rest of the book. Did you get that feeling, or what do you think about
it? It gets a lot more space. It's longer. That chapter where they get together is longer than anything else in the book. She's really diving into it, down to the toothbrushes. So, yeah, it does feel different. And it didn't, I understand what you're saying about it being a vehicle for keeping her kind of squashed down, but it, in another way, it gives her such a moment to shine. I think her intellectual gifts are really on display when she's telling him off in that car after the fact. And I found that so satisfying. It's also just, there are so many. There are so many predatory men. They should be in novels called out.
Well, I was thinking about that, too. We've talked about so many of them this is like the 17th time we've done this, and there have been at least three or four.
Vladimir.
Right.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Just on this.
The one we did a couple of times ago with the boarding school.
God, why am I not remembering?
I have some questions for you.
I have some questions for you.
Or something like that. Yeah. I just read that. It's funny that you said that because, yes, I was thinking the exact same thing when I was reading that of the connection with this.
Well, and we also did the sequel to Election.
Oh, that's the other. Election was the other one I was thinking of. It's interesting to re-watch Election now because it's like Tracy Flick is, when it came out, was meant to be this character that we ridicule, and she was so awful, and she compromised. It's like it's as though she compromises the teacher, when in fact, now, the way I see it, is the exact opposite. It's very interesting how that's flipped.
She got a raw deal.
Yeah, she really did. Yeah, she became the symbol of every
type
striving
A woman.
Woman.
Now I'm like, oh, sorry, Tracy Flick.
So what do we think about, let's talk about Vacaville for a minute. What do we think about that? I mean, Susan, you have written about, you know, kind of dying Indiana towns.
I thought she just nailed it. I mean, it's about her phrase, it's probably not hers, but the extraction economy, which then becomes very much like what the older teacher does to her, just extract what you can. And the idea that it was the automobile, Zorn automobiles, which is kind of a stand-in, I think, for Studebaker.
Sure.
The corporation came, took all the people, you know, took all the resources, and then left everybody there like, what just happened? And then they had, you know, just so many brilliant descriptions of the kind of post-industrial Midwest, I thought, throughout this book. That was one of the strengths. Well,
there were two things I thought were funny. One was that Zorn is German for wrath. Did you happen to remember that? But I pulled out a couple of the descriptions that I thought were really apt. This one is Moses speaking, and he says he's describing Middle America, and it's their churches and their supermarket smiles, their canned corn, which travels thousands of miles before returning to the land that produced it, their American flag, flags and the yards, their minivans and Christian schools, the roads, the unwalkability, their hard and friendly R's, sweet gas station clerks, the faith and anger and geometry, all highways and God. Huh. And then there's another description. I can't remember who's speaking here or who's describing, if it's just the author, but it's Vacaville is yet another American blemish, one of those disposable, expired towns responsible for electing the demagogues who reduced their country to a trash fire.
Exactly. And then she also says that, I love that line.
Yeah.
Zorn was why you saw your dad cry, why you didn't have a dad, why he overdosed or dealt, why he was doing time. And, you know, goes on and on explaining all the bad things sociologically that are happening in Vacaville and blames it on Zorn having extracted things and then left.
And left benzene in the water.
And left benzene in the water. Amazing.
I love this, too. And then this is here's the vision, right? When they're in Maxwell Pinky's apartment or his townhouse or whatever it is, and they're talking about the building he wants to build. And it's a renovated automobile factory, one of Pinky's luxury constructions, located downtown on the banks of the polluted river, just a 10-minute walk from the rabbit hutch. The building is unoccupied now, with the air of a television set. But when the tech talent relocates in Vacaville, Pinky is confident that the condominiums will sell right away. He wants coastal urban people to feel at home in this complex. 16-foot ceilings, cement floors washed in the hue of jade, large windows. Light pours in from all sides, despite Vacaville's permacloud. Perfect temperature, new appliances, showers with too many settings, climate safety and music controlled on one's phone, a sauna and a gym in the basement, grills and sofas on the roof. The sun casts Blandine's hair into an aura around her skull. Jack fixes his attention on the bruises that cloud her legs. It's just we've built that building many times downtown
in
Indianapolis.
I know.
It seems to me she really got that well. So we've talked a little bit about Blandine, her quest to be good and wonder if she's good even. You know, very early she asks if the little act of eco-terrorism she's going to commit will reveal her to be a moral or immoral person. What does anyone think? Is she a moral or immoral person?
Well, I mean, it's always the thing with terrorism. It's the quote, one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. So I think anytime that question gets asked, it depends on which side you're on. I mean, for me, I guess I would say that she's not an eco-terrorist, but if you were on the developer side, I could see why you would say she was. And I just think that's, especially, it's such a strange time to be talking about that anyway, but that is, it's hard to define. It's such a subjective word.
And as an eco-terrorist, she's not particularly terrifying. I mean, the blood that comes down from the ceiling is a
roommate, so much more terrifying.
Yeah. I think she felt like she had to do something, but...
But didn't it feel like, for me, it was like there's that one incident, and she's kind of planning another one.
Right.
But it was strange that there was so little focus on all of that, ultimately. Mm-hmm. I found that kind of confusing. I'm not sure how to explain that.
I'm not quite sure how to either.
Well, I wonder. Okay, so let's think about that for a minute. A couple of things that come to mind, first of all, are she's definitely a cogitator, and she's young, and there's a lot of... messing around trying to figure out who she... I mean, she's got to change her name, for crying out loud, to try to figure out who she is. And one of the other things that really struck me is that there's... As people are evaluating her in this book, what is always being evaluated is whether or not she's pretty, which is also kind of a...
So aggravating.
It's so aggravating, but yes, it's just another way.
It's your value.
Yeah, showing her value.
I do have this one quote about whether she herself considers herself to be ethical. And this has more to do with the mysticism stuff than the eco-terrorism stuff. But she says, in order for her life to be considered ethical, she must try to dismantle systemic injustice, but she doesn't know how to do that. She always knew she was too small and stupid to lead a revolution, but she had hoped she could at least imagine one. She takes a deep breath, attacked by an awareness of how impossible it is to learn and accomplish all that she needs to learn and accomplish before she dies.
And she says in the cart too, well, I'm not smart enough to lead a revolution.
Yeah.
And the last thing I want to say about all this is she changes her name and then realizes that she changes it to Mild, and her earlier name meant something light.
It's Tiffany is Greek for manifestation of God.
Right. Right. So it's kind of, it's a little bit about like finding your way and making some bad choices.
Yeah.
Or choices that have unexpected consequences.
Or choices without all the information.
Yeah, that's you.
Baby.
I think that, part of what she's doing too, again, it's the mysticism. And she quotes Simone Weil someplace in there. I couldn't find where I wrote it down, but something about how if you just see one other person as real, then you have done a good act. I mean, and that's like what a lot of the female mystics were always saying, pay attention, see this other person as real, realize that every single thing you do, it has an effect on everyone else. I mean, I think that that's maybe the conclusion she comes to. And so the terrorism isn't really, you know, I don't know. It seemed like at the end, it really isn't that important to the book.
It doesn't seem like it is.
It seems like more than anything, it's like that would be partly what I would take out, except maybe she has to do it in order to get to the conclusion where I just have to be able to see other people. And
one thing I did do, because I was curious about the original Blandine, like the real mystic Blandine, mm-hmm. So Wikipedia, source of all truth, it actually says about the actual mystic, her companions greatly feared that on account of her bodily frailty, she might not remain steadfast under torture. But although the legate caused her to be tortured in a horrible manner, so that even the executioners became exhausted as they did not know what more they could do to her, she remained faithful. And I just thought, what a motto. May you exhaust your executioner.
Right. That's a good one.
I'm going to cross-stitch that into a pillow.
Right.
Boy, I love it.
That's stoicism in its finest.
Yeah, I just love that.
So, Susan, we talked about the mystics a little bit. She says early on, Blandine wonders how a modern mystic would challenge the plundering growth imperative. And is that what she was doing? And what do you think that has to do with leaving her body, with her obsession with leaving her body?
Leaving her body. I don't know. That's a really good question. I think that, you know, part of the thing she comes to the conclusion that the mystics were known, the female mystics were incredibly strong, usually virgins, often anorexic. You know, there are mystics who said they would eat nothing but the Eucharist, or, you know, air was fine to sustain you, so we didn't need to bake goods, for instance. So I think, you know, the question of somebody who decides to like be married to God or married to Christ, and then also doesn't care anything about the body. And Blandine, in a way, is like that. She's pale, she's thin, she's almost not even there. She's like Targaryen on Crown of or Game of Thrones or something. She looks kind of like her to me. But so I think, you know, that's her question. Would a modern mystic do something, maybe, like, you know, try to stop it? Or does a modern mystic go to the grounds where they're going to turn what is basically Eden into one of those, you know, high-rise places like a new Silicon Valley, and just see it and be part of it and find within the physical, a portal to another world. I think, because one of the things she said she loved about mystics is that they see portals everywhere, so that, you know, the physical world is also the spiritual world, I think, and that's what Blandine is kind of thinking. So then what do I do? How can I, you know, make a difference,
Now that you've brought that up, made that point, it makes me wonder, you know, how she makes a big deal about not being on social media?
Yeah. Oh.
It's almost like she's stepping out of culture in the same, or society in a certain way, the way a mystic might have.
Right.
You know, there's a whole quote about it that it's kind of long, but should I go for it?
Oh, sure. My gosh.
Yeah.
I was just going to find it to read it if you weren't going
to. It convinces every user that she is a minor celebrity, forcing her to curate some sparkly and artificial sampling of her best experiences, demanding a nonstop social performance that has little in common with her inner life, intensifying her narcissism, multiplying her anxieties, narrowing her worldview, all while commodifying her, harvesting her data, and selling it to nefarious corporations so that they can peddle promises to make her prettier, smarter, more productive, more successful, more beloved. Everybody influencing, everybody under the influence, everybody staring at their own godforsaken profile, searching for proof that they're lovable. I was like, oof. I feel like I should delete all my accounts,
right.
but I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
The interesting thing to me is that the writer is so clearly aware of social media, though, like, so many of the paragraphs are about things like...
Oh, like the comments in the obituaries.
The comments in the obituaries, or that whatever that thing is that you get on and you listen to somebody just brushing their hair.
Oh, what's ASMR. It called?
ASMR, yeah. That baby boomers don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, different things like that. So she is, like, totally, you know... in tune with whatever is going on.
What's your favorite ASMR? Mine is bathtub water running. That's my fave.
I listen to 12 hours of brown noise at night. Does that count?
Yes, that absolutely counts.
I mean, not all 12 hours. That's just how long the thing is. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've gone over half an hour here without mentioning the boys.
Oh, good. I'm dying.
Tracy? You're on.
Okay. So I'm mystified that, to set it up, apparently at least two out of three of these boys are in awe of Blandine and trying to impress her, which one does by bringing home a fish that he finds half dead. And then...
Which inspires a whole...
A whole
killing spree.
Killing spree.
It is an odd love language.
At the end there, kill the goat that she's trying to care for, which seems counterproductive. I don't know what to make of any of it.
I found them confusing for sure.
Mm-hmm. I did too.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, other than... I guess the only thing I can say, maybe this has to do a little bit with the thing that you've had flagged, Ken, about the story that Moses, his ex-girlfriend, is talking about, and how maybe those are sort of stand-ins for how we can't even look after our own children.
Is anybody else familiar with that story? I actually heard Peter Singer do that once.
I have it here.
It's the story of the drowning child, and the expanding circle.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah. So
it's kind of the basis of the whole effective altruism movement.
Do you want me to read the thing?
Please.
I'm so embarrassed how overprepared. So the idea is that if you passed a child drowning in a shallow pond, you would help it out, no questions asked, even if you had to ruin your clothes. Then Singer asks his students, would it make a difference if the child were far away in another country, perhaps, but similarly in danger of death and equally within your means to save at no great cost and absolutely no danger to yourself? The students always say no. Singer says his students never challenge the underlying ethics of the idea that we ought to save the lives of strangers when we can do so at relatively little cost to ourselves. And what that made me think of is, we aren't even saving the lives of the kid in our pond. I mean, so those kids for me felt a little bit like that. Examples of lives that we're not doing anything to save.
Well, and really, I mean, I think it's maybe just sitting here talking about it, but, you know, what do those kids have in common with Maxwell Pinky? Are they going along with the plan to murder the one good thing left in the town?
Well, not Jack. I mean, he's for Pinky. I mean, he seems when they're in his when they're in Pinky's apartment, because right. he's the dog walker.
But is that murder of the goat, you know, you know, some kind of horrible symbol of both Pinky and Jack working together to make a horrible place a different kind of horrible?
It's definitely a sacrificial kind of act.
Yeah, that whole thing, I was confused. Yeah. Tracy, yeah. I feel like you have more to say.
Well, I don't. I just, no, I'm mystified by it, and I didn't believe it just because it escalated so fast in such an extreme way.
What logic is there? There was no like system of logic where you'd go, well, yeah, that's a natural next thing to do to try to impress this person, you know?
Right.
I felt the same way. Yeah. It's when that happened, I thought, where did this come from? Mm-hmm. And so I had to think about it. And, you know, you'd like to actually also feel it.
Right.
And, you know, to think about it, then I thought of all the rabbits and the, you know, the thing at the beginning about how male rabbits pee on each other, you know.
Yeah.
And how they're all those sweet rabbits in the woods, but they could kill you. You know, they look like they could. And then how the goat just sort of appears when she's reading about, you know, God separating the goat from the sheep or something, like, you know, Hildegard had sent the goat as a symbol or something, and then she's killed instead. And that just seemed like that didn't make any sense to me, except for allegorically or something, and want it to be
agree.
Both.
I agree.
Well, and then again, as soon as you saw the goat, you knew what was going to happen.
Right.
Right? You knew that goat was going under the knife in the rabbit hutch. So what is with the rabbits? Why the rabbits?
I have a theory.
Please.
Yay.
Oh, good.
Well, they're kind of the bottom of the food chain, and I had this realization when my dog murdered a rabbit while I was reading this book, so that was awesome.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa. Meta.
Awesome. Sorry about that. So they're at the bottom of the food chain, so they're very vulnerable, but yet they proliferate so much. So, in fact, as a species, they're quite resilient, and it almost mirrored some of the characters in the book. They're so vulnerable, but they're so resilient. And that was the only thing that I could think of that made any sense to me.
All right.
I like it.
That sounds good. And it kind of, did everyone also see in the illustration, one of those illustrations was a falcon and a dead rabbit?
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the falcon, I thought that was interesting, too, because that's like the hood ornament on the Zorn automobiles.
Right.
But you also have that falcon cam in the church. So I thought there were some cool things happening with falcons as well.
And there's also the picture on the front of the book, which is God piercing the heart, I think.
Right.
And so there's, I don't know, this kind of piercing of innocence or something.
Well, and even isn't mysticism sometimes described as like a piercing? And there's something there too, maybe.
I also wanted to point out, I mean, I think obviously there were some really well-researched things in this book too, like Moses's condition, like that's a real thing. Like,
is
that,
it really?
Oh my gosh! Like Joni Mitchell has it.
What?
Yeah,
I had no idea.
Right.
Oh, that'd be horrible. Can you imagine?
I know. It's like that you have like threads coming out of your skin or something
that. What's her name? Wrote a book about her husband having that. I'm not going to remember her name. We did something with her on for Punchnells way back when.
Oh.
So, yeah, I knew about that, the thread thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to find this.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, while Tracy is looking that up, why do you think Joan became the person who finally connected with Blandine at the end?
I mean, I'm sorry, I'm kind of hogging the mic here. So
oh, please do.
I do have...
Tracy's this, otherwise engaged.
I have yeah, I am otherwise head. Engaged okay. looking at mine.
So I just thought, there. Were, I actually really liked that.
Yeah.
Because I feel like in a way, it felt to me like those two were becoming each other's person. Mm-hmm. And it was a surprise, but, well, first of all, it reminded me a little bit of, you know how there's this, they both talk about being awake, and it yeah, happens right. twice. It happens yeah. when they first encounter each other in yeah. the laundromat. And Blandine says to Joan, "We're all just sleepwalking. Can I tell you something, Joan? I want to wake up. That's my dream, to wake up." And she also says to Joan, I think we should all take each other a little more seriously. And I love both of those, but the awake thing made me think of Thelma and Louise. Does anybody remember that scene when they're driving in the desert and Thelma looks over at Louise, Gina Davis is Thelma, and she's like, "I feel awake." And I just, it made me think of that. Like, it's such an empowering way to feel. But I did, I
well,
just...
and then at the end also, when Joan is in the hospital,
she tells
the receptionist she wants to wake up.
To the receptionist, "I think we should all take each other a little more seriously," verbatim.
Right, right.
But, and then she says, "I want to wake up."
Right.
And then that's how the book ends. I mean, right. She, and I also just love the idea of them being each other's emergency contact. You
yeah,
know, like
I
how,
like
I mean, I don't know that they actually officially become each other's emergency contact, but I love that that's what they have that in common. Neither of them has an emergency contact. And I thought it was a natural
So it's about
connection.
Their friendship.
Yeah, I thought it was like a natural beginning to a serious relationship. And one other thing that Joan says at that time is that she wants to be more neighborly. And I just felt like neighbor kept coming up. The mm-hmm. show was called Meet the Neighbors, the mm-hmm. show that Elsie was in. And you begin with this overview of all these neighbors. And I thought just neighbors became kind of a theme for me. And really at the end, that hooked in for me as well.
I think that waking up thing is it's so powerful, because all the way through the characters are saying, "I'd like reality to feel a little bit more real."
Yeah.
I love that too. All the characters are kind of like asleep, you know, like who's, oh, Todd will sit there watching TV mm-hmm. and watching people being tortured, and he's not upset by it. Whereas he sees the little, kind of
commercial
fake
for Vodka
Right. for Vodka Vale, where everyone's happy and drinking coffee and, walking around, and it's beautiful. And Blandine looks at him and says, "You mean you can, watch those people being tortured with absolutely not being upset at all, but then you start crying when you see this commercial for tourism?" So it just seems like everyone's kind of asleep. And that's mysticism, too. It's like how to wake up to what's really real. And at the beginning, she wants to be awake. And at the end, she and Joan, who have have a real connection and I think see each other as real, they want to wake up. And I think,
that's beautiful.
That's what the book is kind of about.
But what are we supposed to wake up to?
Reality. What's real?
Well, yeah, and I think that's where you get into the sort of we do exist on this constant diet of chatter. There's so much chatter in our lives, and we tune it out. I think we all exert a lot of energy tuning things out. So
she said that economy or attention is the thing we need to, have more of, paying attention, seeing things, being awake to the world. And particularly, I think, because we're all on our screens and our phones, I think Blandine would say we're not awake at all.
She says, I want a life that's a little more lifelike.
Yeah.
Don't you?
She says to
Joan. And I do think... ultimately, if I had to pick one thing, I do think that's probably what the book is meant to convey.
It's just wake up.
Yeah.
Wake up.
And just
and
even because it blurs.
Spoil the earth. Don't despoil other people. Don't sacrifice other people. Pay attention to the person who's like miles away.
Yeah, there's so much blurring of reality and people almost displace celebrities for neighbors. You know, it's like you, you right. think That's you know idea. Elsie better right. than you know the person who lives right. above
well,
you.
Well, Matthew Perry just died.
Right, right. So we all grieve in this way that's strange. Like, we don't know this person, but yet we feel like we do. And now it's to the point where we have substituted it. We don't even... I mean, that's all we have. You know?
Taylor Swift. Yes. I'm so obsessed with Taylor Swift things online. Like, why? I don't know her, but everybody right. feels yeah. like they do.
Well, even how there's one description I really liked. It says the park is so verdant, it looks like a screensaver. and I think too, like you could see, like in the content, or I'm sorry, the comments of the obituary. It's like people really believe that they know Elsie Blitz. Like, yeah, she's not Susie Evans, but it doesn't matter because that's all they think of her as. She'll never be anything else. And right. I think we definitely have, as we've lost connection with each other, all our attention has been diverted in this way to this weird celebrity culture, which isn't real.
Yeah. Tracy, I think you found what you were looking for.
I did find the book. It's by Eleanor Henderson, Everything I Have Is Yours.
Wow.
And she also wrote 10,000 Saints.
Yeah, right.
Right. It's a great memoir of a marriage, really. Although it's, oh my God, frustrating.
Huh. Okay. That sounds awesome. Okay. Let's do a little lightning round here. What is the best tagline for Vaca Vale? Vaca Vale, don't touch the rust. Vaca Vale, we'll clean it up in the morning. Vaca Vale, we used to make cars here. Vaca Vale, where rabbits outnumber the churches. I remember trying to do some for Indianapolis. My favorite one was Indianapolis, lowest prices on cigarettes.
Which I think is still true.
I think it is too.
That's so funny.
What do we, were there any of those we touched a little bit about, but there were all those little bits of stories about the other people in the building. Did any of those resonate? We spent the most time with Hope and her baby's eyes, Tracy.
Yeah, and then her and her husband avoiding the flood in the hotel.
Yeah.
For no real payoff. Mm-hmm. I don't think. Well, apparently there was for them because she's impregnated. But if we were following Kate's suggestion to cut some stuff out, mm-hmm. I think Hope and her husband and her baby could go, and probably all of those little vignettes about the people in the building. Because I was with you when that chapter came so early, and it was so, I mean, you got to really work for those chapters when they're early in a book and it's this person and then that person and then this couple.
Mm-hmm.
I expected a different kind of novel.
Me too.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Just to go way out on a limb, this is probably not in any way what the author intended, but I kind of felt like the fractured nature of them almost felt like visions. The way a mystic would experience a vision, but I feel like that's a real reach.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, there was that whole thing about Moses and the letter from Mr. Body.
I would have cut that.
Yeah.
I would have cut that right out. Susan?
Yeah, it's just...
Oh, I'm trying to remember the whole clue game and everything.
Right. Yeah.
That was really weird because then doesn't Moses sort of turn into him?
Well,
or something?
Yeah. I mean, like he says, I stayed in the hotel and I paid cash for it and I used a pseudonym.
Maybe I killed somebody.
Right.
Right. It was
that
part of
gone.
His life.
It was a long kind of diversion, though.
Yeah.
I don't mean to make
letter.
It. This sounds aggressive, but I feel like it's indulgent. Those kind of things in a book for me feel indulgent and they bug me. And I don't mean to insult the writer because, again, I think she's extremely talented and I loved her words. But those types of pieces in a book just irritate me because somebody just needs to say, you need to take that out.
That's sort of what I meant by feeling kind of like an MFA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like brilliant. Like you don't want to let it go.
No,
but if it's not in service of the story, you have to take it out.
And I can even see how she would argue.
Yep.
It and it's interesting.
I wonder what she'll do next. Because this is a strong, I mean,
For
we're saying
sure.
a lot of negative things about it, but it is a strong long novel.
Yeah, it really is.
It has beautiful words.
It really does. Okay.
And it's meaningful. I mean, yeah. I feel like, yeah, it's, I felt like it was very true about Indiana in a way. And in another way, the rabbit hutch itself felt more like Brooklyn.
Oh, sure.
Which is where she wrote the book. So there, you know.
Sure, where you're all on top of each other.
Yeah, where you're, it was more
Interesting.
Vertical rather than horizontal.
Yeah, because in the countryside, in rural Indiana, and in those towns, it's spread out, right?
It's spread out you know. I mean, South Bend, perhaps a little bit different, but still.
Yeah, I can. That's interesting.
All right, I have two questions for everyone. First of all, would you recommend the book? And second of all, you're all writers. Write your own obituary. Good idea or bad idea? Susan?
What was the first question?
Would you recommend the book?
Yeah, I definitely recommend the book and have recommended it. And I'm excited to see what she does next. And writing an obituary, it's probably a fine idea. This woman did a great job. People have been doing it more, I've noticed, in the paper, writing their own obituaries.
Awesome.
I don't know.
Kate, what do you think?
It would depend, I think, on the reader who I would recommend it to. If it was a person who really liked literary fiction, then yes, because the language is so beautiful. If it was a person who was more of a person who enjoyed plot more than language, I would say no, because I feel like it does a little bit fall apart as it goes structurally. As for the obituary, I did think that was one of the best parts. I thought it was really funny. And as she says, in an era of confessional status updates, factory farmed memoir, and federal tweeting, it seems appropriate to deliver my own farewell address. And who ultimately you're taking control of your narrative, which is a little bit of an egotistical thing to do.
Sure.
But at the same time, you're reflecting on your life, and I don't see the harm in that.
I don't either.
Yeah. Tracy?
I would recommend this book. I have recommended it a lot. I had such a fun time reading it. I think that writing your own obituary is a magnificent exercise that I'm going to definitely do, but you have no fucking control over what happens to it.
Yeah, so don't get your hopes up.
That is true. That is true. Well, I will agree. I think it was quite a fun ride, and I am really interested to see what she does next. It's not a book I would recommend to everyone, but it's a book I would recommend to a lot of people. And now, having said that, does anyone else have another book they would like to recommend to other people?
I forgot this part of the assignment.
Tracy?
I am so excited to recommend an anthology that I am included in and that Barb Shoup, our other
that's my mom.
Often, you know, book club member, is included in. It's from a press started by Eliza Tudor, who was in the Butler Creative Writing MFA program with me. It's called Playing Authors from Old Iron Press. So check it out. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. She did such a great job putting it together.
And Tracy, I think we're going to be on the air before your launch party. When is that?
It's Saturday, November 11th. Yeah.
Then we're going to be, if you hear this, go right on down to Tomorrow Bookstore.
Hop down to Tomorrow Bookstore, right. Yes.
Yeah.
What time is it?
7:30.
All right. Awesome. Susan.
I would recommend, I'm reaching into the vault here. One of my favorite writers is Iris Murdoch, and she wrote a book called The Bell that reminds me a little bit, has a character a bit like Blondine, and she's also fascinated with the mystics, and it's a wonderful novel. I could pretty much live on Iris Murdoch novels for the rest of my life, perhaps. And then also there's a new translation of Julian of Norwich. It's Revelations. I can't remember who the translator is, but it's supposed to be really good. And Blondine kind of quotes all the way through from Julian of Norwich, which Iris Murdoch does too in The Bell. So
yeah, interesting. Okay, Kate.
Well, I kind of fell recently into what I call the Jane Austen universe.
Oh, you know what? I just read Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, it's just one of my favorites. And so I didn't really intend to do this, but I read a book called The Other Bennett Sister by Janice Hadlow, which is about the sister who doesn't get married in Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, yeah.
And I actually really loved it. And then I also read a book called Longbourn, which was about the staff in the family home. So, like, the servants. And I actually really like that, too. I was going to recommend I Have Some Questions for You, but I didn't realize you guys had already read it.
Well, you can still recommend it.
I did like it. It reminded me of The Secret History, that Donna Tartt book. But and then I recently read You Could Make This Place Beautiful. That's that poem.
Yeah.
It's a memoir. I read that too. It's lovely.
But I didn't like the last book I read, which was John Irving's new book called The Last Chairlift. I was sad. I just didn't. It was 400 pages too long.
You know, the assignment was one book.
Sorry, I know. You know,
and you said you didn't have one.
I went back.
That's
and
what
looked.
Happens when you don't have one.
I know. I know. But I was just don't. I mean, it's so long, and it doesn't. It's just, and also part of why I read it is because I grew up skiing in the 70s, and I was like, oh, it's going to be no. There was very little of that.
All right. Well, I mentioned earlier that I felt like there was some kind of tonal similarity to David Foster Wallace. But I also found an interview with the author who said that her go-to work of nonfiction was David Foster Wallace's collection of essays, A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. So that is going to be my recommendation. There are some really great essays in that book. Tracy, I'm sure you have read the tennis essays in that
of
book.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Derivative Sport in Tornado Alley, and the other one, tennis player Michael Joyce's Professional Artistry as a Paradigm of Certain Stuff About Choice, Freedom, Discipline, Joy.
God, I just have no patience for David Foster Wallace, to be honest.
It's
so tedious.
That says a lot about him, doesn't it?
Was that the title or the whole essay?
That wasn't even the whole title.
Oh, my God.
But it's also got, you know, A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again is one of the great comedic essays of all time. And I can't say I ever have ever wanted to go on a cruise, but that said everything I've ever thought about why I would never want to go on a cruise, whether it was true or not. And apparently a lot of it was not, but still. And that's about it for us. You can find this notes for this and all of our shows in the Radio Free Book Club blog on medium.com. Please think about dropping us a note on Facebook and stream the show wherever you listen to podcasts. We're always interested to hear what you think about the book and the show. Our show is produced for 99.1 WQRTLP by the always delightful Oreo Jones. For Tracy Kumbe, Susan Neville, Kate Shoup, and all the members of Radio Free Book Club, I'm Ken Honeywell. Thanks for listening. And join us next month when we'll be discussing the first new book in a whole lot of years from Tim O'Brien.
Oh.
It's called America Fantastica,
yes.
And we know we're going to enjoy talking about it. Until then, read a book.